the infiltration case ends, and then my true identity, like who they thought to be J. Bird Davis, turns out to be J. Dobbins. The gunrunner debt collector turns out to be an ATF agent. So the Angels issued contracts on me. They were farmed out to the Aryan Brotherhood. They were farmed out to the MS-13. 18th Street picked one up here in Los Angeles.
I want to start just by saying how much of an honor this is for me, man. Like, we're full disclosure, we're meeting for real the first time today. It's a joy for me, and I'm so grateful that you would do this. I read your book years ago, and I was utterly blown away and fascinated. In my opinion, you're nothing short of a hero. You exemplify courage, strength. You're a wild man. I learned so much, strangely, about my whole acting process by the way that you approached your work. I do it, you know, my work is putting on makeup and saying lines for a living, and I operate under the umbrella of safety. You put yourself out there in such an insane way in your life, and I have so much respect for you, and I'm so glad that I get the chance to actually kind of meet you and look you in the eye. So thank you, man. Thank you for coming, bro.
So when you compare like acting to, you know, and like your process.
Yeah.
So I've been in a couple films, mm-hmm. right? Acting, playing a cop.
Yep.
Right. Is much harder to do as an actor than it is to do operationally on the street.
Why is that?
When you're acting, you have a script to follow.
Sure.
You have a director there who's orchestrating things.
Sure.
You're surrounded by a crew, and it steals all your spontaneity.
Yep.
Like if I'm out on the street, I can take it and I can control the situation however I want.
Yep.
By what I say, by what I do, by my actions. You don't have the freedom for
right,
that as
right,
an actor.
Right.
So like when I've had some acting spots, like small, right? Nothing to be of significance. I thought it was super hard.
Sure, sure.
Like you have to deliver a line and you
sure.
have to like honor the writer's
sure,
words.
Sure.
And the director's instructions and all the people looking. I thought it was way harder.
But I imagine with so many of the undercover agents that you've worked with over the years, I'm sure you, I mean, there was something that set you apart, correct? Like your ability to improvise, your ability to go deeper, your ability. I mean, we're just talking about Mel Chancy, and I want to get into like a proper introduction, all that. But we're just talking about Mel Chancy, and I one of the things that really struck me is you know, when you were in New York, you were there, I think, at like a convention, or you were there with like a bunch of other ATF agents, and you were like, I want to go over to the Hells Angels clubhouse. Like, I want to just go over there because you're so sort of deeply, you know, in this guy and in this guy's soul and in this guy's shoes. And, you know, the other agents were like, you out of your fucking mind, but you made your connections. You called your people in Arizona. They got you in. And that's where you met
yeah.
Mel, who's a friend of both of ours, you know, sort of legendary Hells Angel. But, you know, you wanting to do that, you having both the urge to do that, knowing that it might help your case, or it might just be that's where you wanted to be. Maybe you felt more comfortable with those guys than you did with the agents at that time. I doubt that that's a common thing for undercover operatives.
I think what is common is there's all these different elements and personalities. The one common factor amongst all the guys that are great is they're audacious. That there's some that have various levels of risk assessment, various levels of courage, various looks, various experiences, understanding of the tradecraft, all those things. But every one of the great ones is yeah. just audacious.
Yeah.
They just have the balls.
Fuck yeah.
To
yeah.
You know, not be afraid to fail.
Mm-hmm.
Be afraid to not try.
Yep.
Yep. Is worse than
yep.
failing.
Yep.
It's like Jordan says, man, you miss 100% of the shots you don't take.
That's right.
So take your shot,
yep.
man. And if risk is a factor in it, you know, then you're probably not going to be very good at it because everything you do is a risk. Everything you do is risky.
Right.
There's no guarantees.
Right. And would you just like quickly, I mean, just you know, with who, I just want people to have an idea kind of who you are. Like, you're going to see very quickly, this is not my fucking day job. You know, this is not going to be, this is definitely not Walter Cronkite. It's definitely not fucking David Letterman. But I wanted to, you know, you...
with all that, I'll dumb it down from there.
I appreciate it, brother. I think, you know, for me, I just think it's really important that people know, look, you know, kind of who you are and where you're from. Because to me, I feel like, you know, like the books that you've written and what you've done in law enforcement in this country and sort of your struggles within law enforcement with the very bureau that you gave so much to, I feel like there's also so much more to you that I don't know, and I'm fascinated to find out. But, I mean, you infiltrated the Hell's Angels and brought probably the biggest case in the history of that organization against them, a two-year process that is really, in my opinion, unlike anything that has like ever really been done in law enforcement before. One thing in your book, and your book just resonated with me in so many different ways, and I've read it now multiple times in my life. You know, you start off by saying very specifically, you did not grow up, you didn't get beat up, you didn't grow up struggling for food, you did not. Tell me a little bit about how you grow up, and tell me a little bit about your sort of first encounters with violence. Because you're a guy who has encountered violence and sort of like walked into the face of violence with a level of courage that I don't think is like sort of anybody else that we've had here before.
You know, when I was a kid, uh-huh. I was the heavyweight champion of sissies. And I
don't believe that, bro.
It's so.
You also got an NFL contract and played 4 years of Division I football and total fucking badass on the athletic field. But yeah,
go ahead. I'll tell you, like, I'm a kid. I'm like 8 years old. There's a neighborhood bully who's beating the dog crap out of me in my front yard. He's bigger than me, stronger than me. He's got me pinned down. I'm on my back, just smacking the crap out of me. And I hear the screen door open on our house, and I'm like, my dad's here, my hero's here, he's coming to the rescue, right? And I can't see him, but I hear my dad behind me saying, keep hitting him. And I'm like, wait a minute, man, keep hitting him. And the bully, like, kind of like is confused, and my dad's like, keep hitting him, hit him like you hit him before I came out. And the kid starts smacking me again, and my dad's like, Jay, are you gonna fight back? Are you gonna do something? Are you just gonna lay there and take a beating? And I'm like, Dad, he's too big, he's too strong, right? So the guy takes a few more blows, gets up, and the kid runs off. He's like freaked out, like his, you know, someone's father's watching him kick his son's ass, yeah. Right? I remember my dad came over and he picked me up and my nose was bleeding. And he's like, you have to learn to fight back, because if you don't, you're gonna be a victim for the rest of your life. Mm. There's always someone bigger and stronger out there than you. You have to fight back no matter what. Like, that was like almost as an 8 year old.
Wow.
Like, I was turned.
Wow.
I was like, you know, and my dad like was my hero, is my hero. He's the best man I've ever known. Mm. The best man I ever hoped to know. Mm. Like, all these lessons in life that was hard for him.
Sure.
You know, and he picked me up and he ruffled my hair, and then he's like, now let's go in and get some ice on that lip.
Yep.
You know, and it, like, for a dad, man, that's hard, like, hard to do.
Super hard.
Anybody that's got a kid.
Sure.
Like now, putting myself in my dad's shoes at that point, I'm like, that was really hard for him. But that was like a teaching moment. Like, hey, I'm trying to raise like a good man.
Sure. Sure. And did that change things the next time that something, was it acute? Was that changed? Is something getting ignited in you?
It changed in a bad way, in that when I did punch back and when I did learn to fight back.
Sure. Got carried away.
I kind of liked it.
Yeah.
I liked being on the other side of it. Sure. And that's just as dangerous.
Of course.
Being a bully's a bully. Good guy's side or bad guy's side.
Of course, of course.
And
was there anything your old man did to kind of curb that in you? Like, did he ever see that side of you? Did he ever ask you to pull back on that or get you to see yourself in a different way?
I think that what he saw and what he enjoyed is, like, when I became involved in sports,
sure,
the recklessness that creates.
Yep.
That's how you play sports, especially when you're an underachiever, especially when you're undersized and under speed and under strength.
Yep.
Like, how do you make up? How do you compete against those people that have all these physical like gifts that you don't have? You're reckless.
Describe yourself as a receiver. You know, the way that you describe yourself in the book, I'd like to say on a much sort of smaller level, not even closer. It's exactly how I used to describe myself as a receiver, as being sort of an underachiever, not the fastest, not the strongest, but that's actually a position that I think is usually sort of goes hand in hand with the glory or the fast guy, you're burning them deep. But you know, the kind of receiver, I love crackback blocks. I loved short yard receptions.
Yeah.
I love dragging people over to get that first down. I love hitting people as that position. Can you sort of describe yourself as a football player?
Yeah, exactly. That I tried to make up for my shortcomings by just playing wild, playing reckless, trying to be fearless. I was never the guy who ran down the sidelines and caught the ball over his shoulder and scored a touchdown and got a date with the prom queen.
Right.
I was the guy who like ran the slant to get the first down so the other cat could catch the touchdown and
date
the prom queen.
That's right.
But I was super proud of that.
Absolutely.
I knew what my role was. It was not to be the star. It was not to be like the glory guy.
Sure.
My role was very defined and very specific, and I embraced it. And that's how I stayed on the field.
And how do you feel like, and you carried that, you know, you were a star player in high school. They took you to University of Arizona, played, you know, Division I college football, you know, got looks from the NFL. I mean, how did the mentality of football, I know you're coaching today, how did football sort of shape you for your career, and how did it, what lessons did you learn from it?
Yeah, I don't think there's any sport that teaches you life's lessons as well as football.
Agreed.
Does. And all the things that come with it, and not just the sport, not just the tactics and the techniques of it, but the teamwork of it,
yeah.
and the coordination that it takes, and like knowing your role and understanding your hierarchy in the process, that's life.
Yep.
That's, you know, football, like acting or producing a film, like an undercover operation, maintaining just a relationship, a personal relationship, running a family, a small business, a big business. We all have the same process. And look, maybe we don't even really, if you haven't thought about it, we don't really understand it. To be like the people that are truly successful in life, the highest achievers are the best problem solvers.
That's right.
So whatever is in front of you, identify whatever that objective is. What's the mission? What's the goal? Then the next step is communication with the people around you. Open, transparent communication where you're exchanging ideas. When you do that, you build trust because now you're part of a team. And then with all those things in line, now you can go solve whatever problem X is, whether it's in your relationship, whether it's boy-girl stuff, whether it's managing kids or a wife or a husband, making a movie, running an undercover operation, small business, big business. It's like our process is the same.
Sure.
And like, if you don't think about it, like all of us spend our entire day solving problems.
That's right. That's right.
And the people that are super high achievers are really good at it.
And you know, you're talking, the way that you're sort of able to put that now is coming from a place of just being an enormously high achiever yourself and looking back on this sort of unparalleled career. But I'm really interested in the guy, like before you went into the ATF, before you decided to become an undercover operative, you know, there's a level, like you use the word recklessness, right? Like I like to think of that. It's what attracts me again in a much different sort of way. It's to the acting. Look, man, again, there's no words for the life that you've lived, and I guess I'm really interested, you know, in this guy who decides to make a life of being an undercover operative in the most dangerous of situations. Where were you sort of like with violence and recklessness at that point in your life?
Well, you know, I'll tell you, the honest truth is I'm very much a common man who's been placed in uncommon situations and then just done the best I could in that situation, found some success at times and failed and made mistakes a lot of times too.
Yeah.
You know, and if we don't talk about the mistakes and if we don't talk about the failures, then what I say doesn't have credibility.
Agreed.
If all we do is like tell hero stories and pat myself on the back.
Totally.
And try to like build upon some myth, then it's all counterfeit.
But what makes it, I mean, what were you hungry for? You know, this decision to go into the ATF and go into this world and wanting to be into, like, what was it about that was, you know, drawing you in?
The intrigue of it, the challenge, like the kind of the one-on-one challenge, the competition of it. Undercover work, you're in competition. It's a competition of you versus either the suspect you're working on, the group you're working on,
yeah.
you're competing with them, and they're yeah. competing against you.
Yeah.
The criminal community is uniquely paranoid, and they have to be, because that's how they stay out of prison.
Yep.
They don't trust you. They don't like strangers. And so there's a competition there. You're like, I'm trying to sell myself.
Sure.
It's Jordan Belfort. It's sure. Wolf of Wall Street. Sure. It's sell me this pen.
Sure.
Well, I'm the pen.
Yep.
Like, I'm selling you.
Yep.
Like, trust me, believe, you don't know me. You don't have any experience with me. You didn't grow up with me. Sell me your drugs. Sell That's me right. your guns. Sell me your bombs. Involve me in your home invasion scheme. Hire me to do the murder you want done.
Yep. Yep.
Selling me.
Yep. Yep. And building that credibility. It's all about building that. That is basically your coat of armor, right? Like, that is how you do that. And is admitting your failures, is that part of building your credibility? Is being exactly who you are? I mean, I really want to talk about, you know, how you work with CIs and how you sort of like build this role. But, you know, look, man, I mean, you're one of your first outings out there, you got shot, right? And can you take us through that story? And I know you don't want to just tell hero stories, but it's a crazy fucking story.
So, and I'm going to tie this to your HBO show right now. There's a tie in here, right?
Please.
To We Own the City.
Love it.
I got hired on a Monday, 1987. I was a failed athlete. I had always planned on playing in the NFL.
Yep.
And then I never had a plan B. I never planned for anything other than that, because that's what I was going to do. Well, you know, it turns out, like, dude, you ain't good enough to play in the NFL, right? So you, like, so now you're left like a lot of young people. Now what? Right? So at the time, this is mid-80s, Miami Vice was popular.
Yep.
And as an audience, we had never seen a cop show like that.
Right.
We had seen all the procedurals, detectives responding reactively to crime scenes, doing interviews, patrolmen, right? And then all of a sudden, Sonny Crockett shows up on the scene and
playing
he's like,
role.
Got the Hugo Boss on, he's riding a Lambo around South Beach, right? And he's going into these mansions and he's meeting with these glamorous kingpins, and there's a ton of cocaine out on some barge in the harbor. And he's got these like stripper models bringing him mojitos. Right. And I'm like, man, that seems pretty cool.
Yeah. Huh? Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So the reality of it is, what I found, the reality is that Lamborghini, it was like a beat down Monte Carlo.
Sure.
Right. And the Hugo Boss suit was like cut off camos and a wife beater T-shirt and flip flops.
Right.
The kingpin that Sonny Crockett was dealing with was some like broke dick dude who didn't have two nickels to rub together, that was sitting at the end of the bar with his plumber's crack hanging
sure.
out.
Right?
The ton of cocaine, it was an eight ball that was so stepped on with baby laxative you'd shit before you'd get high off of it. Right? And then the stripper models that like you see on TV that are like running with these cats, they're like straight skanks with like three teeth in their head and tits like sweat socks with rocks in the toes. And so when I experienced it, and it was so much different than what Hollywood had sold me on.
Sure, sure.
I fucking loved it. Yeah. Every day, man. Every day I loved it. It wasn't glamorous.
Yeah, yeah.
Undercover work is a nasty, dirty, bloody, vomit-covered scab of a life.
Yep.
And when I realized that, I still loved it, man.
Yeah, yeah. And what was it that you loved?
I loved the challenge of it. I loved the competition of it. I loved how dirty it was.
Yep. Yep.
I didn't have to be the guy with the gold chains and the Rolex and all the, you know, driving the Ferrari.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Like, I didn't care. I'd show up like on a bicycle for deals. Ride a bike. Because that's how some of those cats roll.
How early in the career was that first event where you got wounded?
So I get hired on a Monday.
Yeah.
Right. So I actually was out here in Los Angeles, got sworn in, and I told my supervisors, I want to work undercover. I came to work undercover.
Sure.
So supervisor digs in his desk and he hands me a cassette tape and some headphones. And all it said on it was Marty. Right. So I plug it in and I'm listening. What it was the audio recording of a Baltimore Police Department narcotics officer named Marty Ward.
Holy shit.
Who, Marty, in December of 1984, was in an undercover deal with a heroin dealer and was shot like five or six times point blank in a drug dealer's apartment. And Marty...
In Baltimore?
In Baltimore.
Uh-huh.
And Marty dies on tape. Marty, like Marty dies with his boys trying to rescue him. You hear him die. Wow. Right? So.
So the guy shot him left, and then you hear his backup unit come in trying to save him.
Yeah, and it is, dude, I'll send you the recording. Mm. It's hard.
Yeah.
It's hard to listen to, right? Yep. So I come out, I'm listening to tape. My boss is like, hey, man, you still want to work undercover? I'm like, yeah, man, this dude's a freaking hero. Like, I'm not going to die doing it, right? So 4 days later, I get hired. I want to work undercover. They make me listen to the Marty tape. They're trying to like, hey, dude, you need to know what you're getting into, right? 4 days later, I get taken hostage and shot. The bullet went in my back. It went in between my...
How did you get taken hostage?
So actually, there's so many stories and backstories to everything, right?
I know.
So like I'm brand new. And like I haven't been to the academy. I don't have any training. I wasn't a street guy, right? So I'm like on the outer tertiary, like most distant perimeter of this arrest operation.
Sure.
The suspect shows up. He shows up on a motorcycle, gets off his motorcycle, parks in front of his house, starts walking in. Boom, boom, boom. All the units, all the surveillance units start swooping in on him to make the arrest.
Sure.
Well, he takes off. He takes off running. And so I'm in so far in the distance, like I'm supposed to just be staying out of the work.
Right.
I see the cat running. Well, I start running.
Right.
So like I wasn't fast enough to play in the NFL. Right. I was slow
but
for the NFL.
D1 wide
but
receiver.
I was freaking yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was Usain Bolt in Copland. Right? So I start, like, I'm passing dudes and chasing. We're running through the neighborhood, and he's serpentine and zigzagging.
Yeah,
And I lose the dude. He vanishes. Yeah. He knows where he's at. I don't know where he's at.
Yeah.
Short time later, like, we're just kind of searching, creeping for the dude. And
do you still have your guys around you? Or
they're,
you
like, we're all spread out.
Staked out, okay.
Distant, right? So everybody's, like, you know, there's, like, no one's really nearby or close. And the dude was hiding, man, and he popped up and drew down on me. And I had my gun, and he was like, motherfucker, I will fucking kill you where you stand, right? And I'm like, you know, I don't remember seeing this episode of Miami Vice,
right?
The dude gets behind me, puts the gun to my head.
And he puts his gun to your head, right? And he says, I'll kill you where you stand. Has anybody ever said that to you in your life? Had anybody drawn a gun on you before in your life?
No.
So now there's a gun at your head. What are you feeling, man?
Well, like I didn't have like those types of life experiences to refer back to. Like, okay, what do I do now?
Right.
But there is a sports element to it. There is a football element to it. Things are breaking bad. There's chaos. There's panic, man. You're losing the game. You don't help yourself by becoming hysterical.
Right.
You find your zen. You find a sense of calm, and you try to like let your computer run. You know. Let the computer work.
I mean, have you ever seen anyone else with that little experience go to that place? I mean, I imagine it's like you were specifically wired that way, both, you know, from football, you know, the blood that your mom and dad put in you. You know, I mean, not most people get a gun to their head like that. And I mean, they're pissing their pants, right? They're not getting tactical. You took a breath and got tactical. And again, it's not hero worship, nothing like that. I'm just wondering what is going through your head. I mean, a gun was once put to my head once in Russia, and I knew I felt like I was this, like I immediately turned into a buck. Right. I was literally like, I'm here for you. I'll do whatever you want. I'm just wondering what went through your, because I know this story. I want you to tell the rest of the story, but like, how do you go tactical at that point? Because I mean, you didn't have a ton of training, right?
No, I had no training, but I think it's an inherent survival instinct. Like panic's going to get me nowhere.
Yep.
Panic's going to get me shot.
Yep.
Like right now.
Yep.
In any kind of situation, like those life and death situations, if you're talking, if you're communicating, you're alive. You're still in the game.
Yep. Just keep moving.
Right. Keep thinking, keep planning.
Okay. And so what happens next?
So the dude, has got the gun to my head, and I talked about this old, like I thought I was coming out of the job to this Lamborghini, right? Like this old Monte Carlo, right? That we'd used to show up there. He stuffs me in the front seat of the Monte Carlo. He gets behind me and he's got the gun to my head. And he's like saying like, go, like get me out of here, right? Like he wanted to use me as his vehicle to escape the situation. Well, now the other agents are starting to close in, right? So I'm thinking like, you know what, man? This probably has got a bad ending, but like, I'm not going to drive this dude away from here with all these other agents, all these other armed agents. I'm not going to drive this dude away from here and have him kick me out and execute me in the ditch 20 miles down the road.
You knew that was what was coming,
yeah,
right?
I was like, if this is going down, it's going down now.
And were you playing the audio, I mean, in your head? I mean, did you go back to the Baltimore undercover agent?
Yeah, absolutely, right? I'd only heard that tape a couple days before, right? So it was like that story was super fresh in my mind. Yeah. And Marty's demise and right? Mm-hmm. So I'm sitting there and I'm sitting behind the wheel and I see a telephone pole like 30 yards up in front, and the first thing I thought is like, I'm gonna buckle my seatbelt and I'm gonna run us into that telephone pole as hard as I can get this car going, as fast as I can get it going, and that's gonna at least give me a chance, right? So I'm going to buckle my seatbelt and the keys are in the ignition of the car, and I'm like, okay, plan B, man. I pulled the keys out and I dropped them to the floorboard. And he's screaming at me like, let's go, let's go, let's, you know, he's messed up.
Sure.
And I reach forward to grab the keys. And when he tried to ride forward with me and the gun came off my head, the gun actually moved to my back. He's trying to stay with me and ride me, right? And he's holding the gun on my back. And then everything breaks bad. He fires around, hits me in the back, goes through my lung. Narrowly misses my heart, exits my chest. And then that inspires like literally this lead and glass storm like that you could only imagine in a movie.
Right.
Right. It was like, it was 5 or 10 seconds. I think like 20 or 25 rounds were fired into the car, right? Into the compartment we were in. So I brought this cause I knew that story would come up.
Holy
right?
shit.
So that hole right there, wow. That's where the bullet went in my back.
Come on, man.
Right? And this hole right here, that hole right out. There is where it came out of my chest.
Wow.
Right? So, like I said, got hired on a Monday. Like this goes down 4 days later on a Thursday with the feds. John, we get paid every 2 weeks. I didn't even gotten a paycheck yet, man. I comped them this one. This was on the house, man. This was like a test drive. Like, hey, man, can I come back tomorrow? Right? And there was like, I mean, I'm laying in the dirt and dog crap of this trailer park. Yeah. And there's blood coming out of my chest like you're holding your thumb over the end of a garden hose. Yeah. Just squirting out. And then they dragged the suspect out of the back of the car because they ventilated this dude, gone. Man. Yeah. Yeah. His eyes are rolled back. He's already got the death rattle going. And so they push me now into the back seat of this car, and I'm like, and I'm in bad shape myself.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so the same car that the shooting took place in, we take off for the hospital.
Holy fuck.
And so like, and my boss was driving, who was like a good, experienced, like old school cop. And he's driving and hauling ass, and he's looking over his shoulder into the back seat, like, hang on. He's called everybody Bubba. Hang on, Bubba. Hang on, Bubba. Stay with me, Bubba. Yeah. And then he's driving and driving and driving, and he's like, man, do you know the way to the hospital? Because we were down this. And I'm like, I got blood gushing out of my chest and like glasses all in me, right? And I'm like, my ears are bleeding. What and like, fuck? So, but you know what? It has a really happy ending. It has a good ending. Actually, the trauma surgeon that operated on me is a guy named Dr. Richard Carmona.
Okay.
And he was this young, like super hotshot trauma surgeon, right? So he patches me up. He saves my life. Dr. Carmona ultimately becomes the Surgeon General of the United States under President Bush.
Wow.
And is a remarkable, amazing man, wow. Amazing life's wow. experiences.
Wow.
So Like, what's the chance that this all goes down and then I land in the hands
the best
of
doctor.
The top trauma surgeon on the planet?
Yeah.
Right? There's like,
you had more to do, man.
There's always a silver lining.
Yeah. And then the decision, I mean, just because I got asked, was there any doubt? I mean, was there any, like, I don't know if this is for me? Like, what, like, I mean, you jump right back in, correct?
Well, so I'm in the hospital and I'm recovering, and like the ambulance chaser attorneys are lining up. Like, it's like trying to return something at Home Depot. Like, hey, take a number, man. I'm now serving number 17, right? They were all taking their turn, and they were coming in saying, dude, you haven't been trained. The government, the agency has assumed a huge amount of liability for allowing this to happen to you. How much money do you want? And I'm like, I grew up in a blue collar house, man. Yeah, my dad was a carpenter.
Right.
And my mom was a house cleaner.
Right.
They're like, you ever seen $5 million?
Wow.
And I'm like, no.
Yeah.
How about $10 million? You know what that looks like? I can get you money that's generational money. Like, you'll never have to work another day in your life. Neither will your kids or their kids if you're smart with this.
Did you have babies yet? You didn't have kids yet? Right.
Like your family will be taken care of forever. And all I could think of was, like get out. Like, there's no cop who ever took a badge and a gun thinking that they were going to get rich.
Right.
Thinking that they were going to... You take it for other reasons.
Right.
And so the money side, like, now at 60, I'm thinking, like, man, you know what? 35 years ago, man, I could have done a lot of money with that money over 35 years, right?
Yeah.
But at the time, I was like, man, all I wanted to do was get back to work.
I understand the honor in that, and I understand, but what was driving you? Like, if you could whittle it down to one thing, like, what was the desire to get back to work? What was the desire? Because, I mean, you still need to learn this trade, and you basically have suffered at this point pretty much the worst. I mean, I would imagine losing a partner or losing somebody would be right, but I mean, you know, you kind of face the ultimate. What was it that was driving you to get into that? I mean, was it this oath that you took? Was it you really want to catch bad guys? I mean, you talked about Miami Vice. What was it?
Failure.
Yeah.
I'd failed.
Did you look at that day as a failure?
Yep.
You did? How so? Yep.
The fact that I was brand new, that, like, by my own mistakes, by my own errors in judgment, by my own inability to assess risk, I had created the situation. No one asked me to come off the perimeter and chase this cat down, right? So I felt like I was embarrassed.
Wow.
I was beyond embarrassed. I was humiliated.
Wow.
I was the joke at the water cooler. Hey, man, did you hear about this dude in Tucson? He was on the job 4 days and he almost got smoked.
Wow.
Freaking had a through and through. Like, wow. It was humiliating.
How common is it for an undercover agent or you know, whatever it was that you were doing at that point? I mean, I think there's, like, a real misconception about sort of the dangers that are out there. I mean, how common is it for an officer like that to get shot?
Well, in today's world versus, like, 1987, it was very uncommon. In today's world, every day we're reading about some cop getting shot. Yeah. Yeah. And not like on a drug deal. Right. We're talking about it's dudes like getting sniped, getting ambushed, right? Getting squared off on traffic stops.
It's almost like the patrolmen are. It's like the most dangerous job now.
It's never been harder to be a cop than it is right now.
So when you go back in, then is there a new commitment to training? I mean, is that sort of like, is that what the next stage of your life is? Is it just like train your ass off?
I knew I could do it, but. My previous plan A was to play professional football, play in the NFL, right? Fail, didn't make it, didn't achieve it. Go to plan B right off the bat, fail. I'm like, man, like, I got to break this cycle.
99.9% of people would say, hey, fuck, man, I played 4 years, you know, University of Arizona. I got, you know, NFL looks like that. That doesn't sound like a failure to me, but what about you made it look that way? Just because your mindset was, I'm going all the way with this?
Yeah, and I think that, like, just my personality is I'm self-critical.
Do you think you need to be self-critical in order to be successful?
I personally do.
Yeah, me too.
I am very rarely pleased or satisfied with anything I accomplish.
Still?
And I always find the mistake or the flaw or the error.
Yep.
Is that good or bad? Man, I don't know.
I don't know either.
I'll tell you that. Like, I think we both know people that achieve on a marginal level, and they'll tell you how amazing they are and how fabulous they are, and they'll pat themselves on the back.
And some of them actually seem pretty happy. Sometimes I'm like, well, fuck, man, maybe I ought to just do that, man.
Ain't that
the
truth?
They're fucking enjoying the weekends while I'm working. You know what I mean? They're with their kids and fucking living life, you know? Yeah, I get it. I get it. And so, you know, I just want to go. I mean, I know then, you know, the next 20 years of your life are dedicated to this, you know, just sort of unparalleled, undercover career. And obviously, you know, most of the notoriety, it goes to what you did with the Hells Angels. But I mean, there were so many criminals that, and so many criminal, you know, enterprises that you infiltrated. And I guess I'm wondering, like, you know, we talked a little bit about like building credibility. And I'm really, really interested in that, like how you do that and how you did that. And so basically, because I know when you kind of came onto the Angels task, you know, you weren't really a motorcycle gang guy, right? Like you were basically, you had this role, right? You were like a hitman. Like what was?
I was not the right choice.
Why is that?
When the opportunity came to work the Hells Angels case, the case agent approached me and said, hey, I want you to lead this undercover operation. And my first response was, I can name 10 guys off the top of my head who will serve this role for you better than I will. They were guys who that was what they focused on. That's what their expertise was. They were, they had built themselves and their experience towards that. I hadn't.
Meaning they had spent the bulk of their career sort of in the outlaw biker communities. They already had connections in those communities.
Exactly.
Where were you at that point? Like,
dude,
what was your guy?
I was like, and I recycled this cover story over and over. I was just this white trash, peckerwood, debt collector, gun runner, quasi hitman at times. And like, I could recycle that over and over and over again. I could play that and make it, I could sell it. I don't care if you're a white collar guy on Wall Street or if you were pushing everything you own in a shopping cart. Like, I could find a way to make that fit and sell it to what you needed in the criminal world.
And how do you sell it?
First of all, you know this from like probably from your early days when you had to audition for films, right? When you had to go read, when you're trying to get started, you get one chance at a first impression.
That's it.
And you better hit it, man. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, if you don't make a good first impression, are you dead in the water? Probably not. But now you've put yourself behind the eight ball, man. Now you got to recover just to get back to even.
Right. Can you think of a time where you feel like you didn't make a good first impression?
Oh, when I didn't make a good first impression, probably with my wife. Right? Put myself behind the eight ball and had to make a comeback. You know,
that's but if all that, of our stories, brother.
Yeah, but
we're
if that
all
goal's
right
out there, if you've got your eyes set on
keep
something, you will
that
keep
motherfucker
going.
Straight up, bro. Straight up. But I guess what I'm wondering is like this character, J. Bird David, like, is that who he was? Like, was he a specific guy? Like, how well did you know this guy that you were playing?
There's, in my experience, there's three types of like undercover operators that like are the high end guys. I'm not talking about like drive through the park and put your hand out and some kid's going to drop a crack rock in
right.
it, like to anybody.
Right.
Right. There's the actors who like put on a costume, whatever that role is, and they inherit that persona and they're acting through it. Mm-hmm. Then there's,
but that's mostly used for like sort of street level. I'm doing this today to achieve this today, not building a persona in order. If I meet this guy, he tells this guy, then you get to meet that guy. You're finally going to get to your target,
yeah.
right? Which is a much different level.
Yeah. So there's people that just like, they almost put on a costume and inherit that. They start acting in that role. Then there's like the hustler, who we all know, who's just like a used car salesman. He sell anybody anything, man. He's the guy that can sell ice to Eskimos, man. And he's always on the hustle,
yeah.
right? And then there's like somewhere in between. There is just the naturals, and I consider myself in that. What you see is what you get.
Yeah.
I didn't pretend to be something I wasn't. I didn't communicate with people I was working on or against any different than I'm talking to you.
Sure.
Like, and you might like me or you might not like me, mm-hmm. but I'm not acting and I'm not pretending to be something I'm not. This is just who I am. So the key in undercover work is like, what value can you bring to whoever it is that you're targeting?
Mm.
If like for the Hell's Angels, there's a million dudes who have Harleys that are sitting at the bar at the end of the bar with long hair and earrings and tattoos who would cut off an arm to wear a Hell's Angels patch. They're not interested in those dudes, right? Because there's a million of those guys. Right. What's your value? What do you bring to the table? Mm. Can you make money? Can you earn? Can you enforce? Can you intimidate? You know, like what level of violence are you comfortable with? All those things that come into play that ended up like in the Hell's Angels example of trying to make myself valuable to them.
Was the focus on the Hell's Angels at that time, was that because of the big shootout with the Mongols? Is that sort of like what, is that what's kind of sparked that major interest, or was there, has there always been?
There was two main events that really inspired that case, like really getting steam. The Hell's Angels Mongols riot at the Harrah's Casino in Laughlin. And the Hell's Angels in Mesa had murdered a woman, an innocent woman.
That was in their clubhouse, right?
Yeah, they basically recruited her off the street to come to a party. The party got out of hand. She mouthed off in the wrong place at the wrong time, man. You don't talk shit on these dudes in their clubhouse, and you don't insult them. She took a beating in the Mesa clubhouse. They beat her down. And then they stuffed her in the trunk of a car and drove her from Mesa out to Apache Junction, Arizona, which is further east, and cut her head off. So that body was recovered, and that there was a tie to the Hell's Angels. Then with the riot, then it was like, look, like we got to do something. The riot was super inspiring because it took place in a public venue. So like gang on gang violence, and when they keep it within their world, like how much can you contain that or control that? These guys are going to fight, man. They're going to get it on.
Right.
But when it spills into the public, when it spills into a venue where there's common man citizen there, it's hard to ignore.
And so for you, I mean, and you got to know very well a lot of the people involved in both of those situations. And I guess, you know, when we go back into building credibility and you and your team, you know, kind of join the ranks of this nomad biker gang. And then when you finally make this approach to the Angels, you know, and you talk about building this credibility and building this, I mean, you guys had this whole, you know, you guys were your own motorcycle club. Like, yeah. How do you go about building that? What are the tools that you need to do that?
Yeah, well, like I said, like we couldn't just show up and right. be like the common man, average Joe coming off the street. Like you don't knock on these dudes' front door and ask for an application.
Right.
It doesn't work that way.
Right.
Right. So my cover story, I used the cover story I'd always used. I was a gun runner. I could make that make sense to him.
How do you make that make sense to him?
I obtain guns in Arizona, cross them into the border in Mexico where they're worth 10 times as much, where the cartels will pay 10 times as much for that gun. It's reverse drug trafficking. Right. Is that still true today? Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Makes sense to them. Like, yeah, that, you know, that was easy. I use my debt collector role. Like I've always got money. I've always got jobs. I've always got work. I've got money in my pocket. I'm not a guy that you're going to have to float.
Yep.
And then that, like the culmination of that, like the violence aspect to it, like I started getting solicited to do murders.
Right.
Because like I never sold myself as a hitman. I never told one of those dudes like, hey man, I kill, you know, I'm a contract killer.
Right.
I kill people for money.
Right.
They assume based on my persona, how I carried myself, my cover story, and then the experience they had with me, like this guy will kill someone.
Yeah.
You know, get approached for it. Like, hey, I'm going to take this dude out. Well, you know.
And you also, you have to do a lot of work with criminal informants. And I'm just wondering, a big part of what you do, I guess where I'm trying to get at, a big part of what you do, I imagine, is you got to get close to people and you got to form like real, honest, genuine relationships with them. And, you know, this guy Pops, I know you guys got like enormously close. And I'm just wondering, you know, you probably had to get close, really close with people who repulsed you and who you were disgusted by. And I imagine you also got close with people that you genuinely liked and cared for, and you genuinely saw like a level of decency in it, whether they're a criminal or not. I'm wondering if you can give me sort of like an example of both of those.
Yeah, so you're presenting this false persona of who you are to people, and right off the bat, you're lying to them. But you can never undercover out of the human factor. So you're actually, you have people targeted and it for various reasons, but they're ultimately, they're still human beings. And so like in the Hell's Angels case, for example, every second of every day wasn't spent in some kind of criminal activity with these guys. So they would be, you know, running their scheme or doing whatever they're doing. And you see that and you become a witness to that, but you're also spending downtime with them, social time with them.
You know, in their homes, in their living rooms.
Holding their babies.
Meals. That's it.
Eating with them.
Yep.
Sleeping at their house. They're sleeping at your house. Shooting pool with them. Drinking beer with them. Like just, and you see like these redeeming qualities in their personalities.
Can you give me an example?
Just guys that like you run around with and you're like, man, like I like this guy.
Yeah.
And you know what? If someone came in here and busted a bottle on the back of my head,
I'm
this dude would be throwing down for me.
That's right.
Right? Like,
right.
Like, don't you build those kind of relationships.
Yep.
The problem is God does not build us to inherently plan on betraying someone. And in undercover work, you know from the very beginning, like, I'm going to try to make a good first impression. I'm going to try to gain your trust. I'm going to gain your loyalty, ultimately. In some cases, I'm going to gain your love. And knowing in the back of your head, and as I'm building this, man, I am gonna, it's gonna be a bad day for you, man.
Ultimately.
I'm gonna betray you.
Yeah, and I find that so interesting. You talked about how you were sort of like this pit bull dog and your sort of superior who is kind of running the show had to kind of hold you back a little bit. And I'm wondering, it's like, how did you manage to have, I mean, you have so many things going at once, right? Like you have this burning desire to take these guys down, but at the same time, you're also getting in some cases extraordinarily close with them and finding things that you bond with, things that you respect about them. Sometimes you love some of these guys, but at the same time, you're also trying to maintain your own real love for your family and preserving them the job and the oath that you took. And I can only imagine, I mean, obviously that sounds fucking insanely stressful, whatever, but I mean, I'm just wondering, like, how do you maintain the real you? Do you maintain the real you? Is it compartmentalization? Like, how does that work?
Well, we've hit on this topic a couple times. I failed at that. Mm-hmm. That's probably my biggest regret, my biggest humiliation or embarrassment is that I was in this undercover role for so long, for such an extended period of time, like well before and beyond the Hell's Angels case, that Jay Bird Davis, the gun runner, debt collector, hitman, stopped becoming what I did for a living, and it started becoming who I was.
But that was necessary, correct? In order to accomplish what you accomplished.
Well, and that was, at least that was my defense to myself and to my wife.
Yep.
I was like, you know what? People that treat this as a gimmick, people that treat what I do as a hobby end up dead.
Yep.
Right? I have to be all in. I 100% because I'm going to get killed if I'm not.
Right.
I had an argument with my wife. At one point I came home. I'd been away from the house for an extended period of time. I walk in like Jay Bird Davis walks into my house, right?
Oh, yeah.
And she's like, you cannot be gone and come here and treat me and our kids and talk to us like we're street people.
Right.
And I was like, I'm not a light switch. Right. I can't turn this on and off. And she's like, well, when you come to this house, you better install a dimmer and dial that attitude down or don't come back.
Straight up.
And I was like, I was super pissed off about that. Mm-hmm. I was like, don't you know I'm saving the world? Mm-hmm. Don't you know I'm doing all these amazing things?
Yep, yep.
And like, and you're going to give me shit for it? Mm-hmm. She was exactly right. She was 100% justified.
Yeah, but you know, it's such a, I guess, because I know how committed you are to your family. I see your relationship and I just in 2 seconds and I and what you said about like chasing that eight ball and making up for lost time. It's such a meditation on fatherhood to begin with, because I just know through your book, you know, you talked about all these kids that you would sort of come upon in the field. You would go into these houses where people are doing meth and they're fucking right in front of their kids. They're selling drugs in front of their kids. There's violence right in front of these kids. And you're seeing these young girls that are being tossed around. You're thinking of your own daughter. And like, you know, I really believe, look, man, for me, in this world, first and foremost, I'm a dad. I'm a father and I'm a husband. That is my primary, that is my North Star, right? And there's times where I have to say, you know, but the bottom line is, and I think this is true for guys who are locked up. I think this is true for guys who are overseas. I think it's true for guys who, for whatever reason, they walked away. They walked away. I feel like that love, that bond is always there, and you always have a relationship with it. And your North Star is how healthy that relationship is. And there's always a way. And I guess it seems to me like it was always present. Your son gave you that rock. You kept that rock with you. You know, like what, like.
I brought it.
Tell that story. I mean, that's who you are. I mean, right. It's like clear. And I guess like what lessons on fatherhood did this whole chapter in your life teach you?
It's going to sound, my answers are going to sound like kind of pathetic almost, or like I'm seeking compassion or sympathy, and I'm not, because fair all enough. The decisions I made.
Fucking A.
No one made them for me. That's right. I own all of them.
Yep.
But it keeps coming back to this element of failure or perceived failure. Like you talked about, like above all, you're grounded in your wife and your kids, right? Like I lost that, man. They weren't the most important thing to me. Like I think inherently, like I'm selfish. That's a very unflattering thing to say about yourself. I made decisions for me, about me, what was good for me, what I wanted to do. And I didn't think about my wife and I didn't think about my kids. You're like along for the ride. And I settled that in my head because I was providing them a comfortable life. They had a nice house. They had food. They had clothes. They went to good schools. You know, my wife had a good car to drive. They didn't have to worry about money. Like I balanced that by saying like, I'm giving you a comfortable sure. life, but I wasn't giving them presents.
Sure.
I wasn't giving
yeah.
them,
yeah.
I wasn't there. Right. I was buying my family.
Mm-hmm.
I was paying for my family by giving them things. And I thought like somehow that was like love or that was a real relationship. And that, I mean, that's, you know, like we're talking to an audience. Like, I don't know the people out there listening to. Sure. That's a pretty humiliating thing to say about yourself. But like we said earlier, if I don't come clean,
yeah.
like I'm counterfeit then.
Yeah. I mean, and also you can't do nothing about nothing until you admit that it's there. I mean, you'll never address a problem unless you look at it, right?
Well, you're like literally when you're like, I was constantly pushing the envelope and I did everything as hard and as fast and as long as I could. And then when the operation was done, like then the fun time came and I partied as hard and as fast and as long as I could. And I pushed the envelope every day on everything and my relationships. And so, you know, like I retired 8 years ago and like the saying, like it's better to burn out than fade away. Mm-hmm. I did both. I burned out and faded away.
Mm.
I spend so much time on my couch now, I've been reupholstered twice.
What is your relationship with the kids like now?
It's really good.
I bet.
And my relationship with Gwen is really good.
I can see that.
But I'll tell you what, of no credit to me, I did every single thing I could direct that. Mm. There was countless times where I should have came home and all my clothes should have been in the front yard and the locks should have been changed. I made a million mistakes with Gwen and my kids, and I'm blessed that they've given me a million and one second chances to fix it.
Beautiful.
And so I'm trying to take that one chance.
Yep.
And trying to like see if I can finally, like on the back half of my life, maybe get it right, because I spent the first half of my life getting everything wrong.
And when you say that, you know, you were like pushing the envelope in all areas, again, do you feel like that was necessary in order to, you know, especially when you were, is that the rock?
It is.
Wow. Wow. Can you tell the story of that rock?
So during the course of like, so my kids never knew me as anything other than an undercover agent. They were born into it. Like Gwen had a chance, man. She knew what I was doing before we got married. So like she had the opportunity to say no. The kids never had an opportunity to say no. Right. So, like well before the Hell's Angels case, through the Hell's Angels case, I'd be gone for an extended period of time, you know, smoking and joking, come home. And I did the bare minimum I had to keep my family functioning. I'd mow the grass, pay the bills, pat the kids on the head, have a cup of coffee with Gwen. Couldn't wait to get back out because I loved being in gangster land.
That's where I thrived.
I just loved like the risk of it, the challenge of it, how dynamic it was, how dangerous it was, that like pushing the envelope, right, all the time. So every time I'd come home and then get ready to leave, my son, who was little at the time, like 8, 10, run out in the yard and say, "Dad, don't leave yet. Like, I got something for you." And he'd come and he'd bring me a rock out of the yard. And hundreds of times I had these rocks. I kept Jackie's rocks. I kept one in my pocket at all times. I had them in the saddlebags of my motorcycle, my undercover car, my undercover house, these good luck charms, right? This kid was giving me these good luck charms. I started handing them out to my partners on the task force. I was like, I don't know, like, what kind of blessing or charm this kid is putting
on. Trust me on this.
But like, the violence is swirling around us. Yeah. 8 or 10 murders took place during that case. Like, all around us, friends of mine, people that I was working on. I was like, please hang on to this rock, right? So the last big operation, we're getting ready to kind of wrap the case up and we're going to go fake this murder, right? And I'm getting ready to leave. And I tell Jackie, like, I'm almost done. And don't leave yet, Dad, don't leave yet. And he brings me this rock, right? And it's this rock. It's the one that I keep with me. And he says, "I've been saving this one for you. It's special. It's shaped like a heart." And so, like, I'm a 40-year-old dad, and I'm trying to comfort, like, this 10-year-old boy. And I said, "All the things that I have been neglecting with you, I'm going to fix. I'm going to get done with this, and I'm going to come home, and we're going to play catch, and we're going to ride bikes, and we're going to wrestle, and we're going to swim and go to the movies." Right? And I said, "It's all because of your rocks, dude, these good luck charms." Yeah. And I'm like, "They work so good. I've been giving them to all my partners." And this little boy standing on my driveway and tears start running down his cheeks. He's standing there, no shirt, no shoes. And he's like, "Those were not good luck charms and you shouldn't have given them to anybody. They were just for you. They were only for you, Dad." And so, like, I'm like trying to figure out, like, for years I thought he'd been giving me good luck charms. And he's like, "That's for you to put in your pocket. And every time you think someone's going to hurt you, you could put your hand in there and touch it. And that would be like me being there to help you fight them."
Wow.
And that was like, that was the worst day and the best day of my life. The worst day is that a 10-year-old boy had to teach his 40-year-old father what my job was. The best day was that my 10-year-old son taught me what my job was. And so, man, I put a huge amount of battle damage on my family. That's what I did to my kids.
Yeah.
All because what? Because I wanted to be Donnie Brasco part two? For what? And then you leave. No one cares. No one remembers you. No one remembers the cases. You know, you retire. And the next day, like, the people on your task force are arguing over the stapler on your desk. Who gets it? That's how important you are.
Right. And then, you know, ultimately this case is like brought against these guys. There's got to be some feeling of like deep satisfaction. There's got to, like, what is that?
So I go through this dispute with my agency after the case, yeah. Right? And I felt like the threats that we had faced, that me and my family faced, that weren't addressed. I felt super betrayed by that.
Sure.
Right. And I was upset by it. And then, like, the light bulb went off one day and my head cleared and I'm like, dude, like, that was your karma, man. You had it coming. You betrayed your family. You betrayed your wife and your kids for this job. Think about all the people over 27 years that you had investigated that you won their love and you betrayed them. Like, how's that feel, man? How you like that? And you know, when it happened to me, I didn't like it very much.
And so once again, you looked at this, like, again, what many would look at as this like massive achievement or whatever, but you looked in your life, you looked at the parts that didn't work. You looked at the parts that were a failure. How can I correct this? First of all, these people that you won the love of and you betrayed them, that these criminals that you ended up bringing down or whatever that is, can you talk about somebody specific that you felt really bad about? That you came to love, that ultimately you brought down.
You know, like I can kind of squeeze that into one story,
sure.
Right? So we we spend 2 years with these guys and meet hundreds of them, right? And indicted 55 people, 16 of them on RICO. We indicted the guys that had beheaded Cynthia Garcia. So I'm briefing the SWAT team. I'm briefing the raid team for the takedown. And in the process, I'm talking about the different characters that they're going to be hunting and where they're going to be.
And so, how violent they are and what to expect. Yeah, of course.
And so in it, I'm like, hey, when you hit JoJo, right? Like, man, like the dude's a pretty decent dude, right? Like, look, I know you got to take him down.
Yeah.
But like this dude, easy, right?
Yep.
Now, Jimmy, when you hit his house, beat his fucking balls ass. Off. Right? Because he's a fucking asshole.
Yeah. And what, and can you describe that line? Like, what is it? Why? What made him an asshole and what made you love Jimmy?
Well, it, probably no different than probably some of them felt about me. Right. It's like you put a group of people together and there's some people you click with, there's other people you don't. Mm-hmm. So the people that I disliked probably had, I'm sure had people that absolutely adored them. Mm-hmm. The people that I liked probably had arch enemies.
Sure.
It was just like the chemistry that I had with certain people, whether it be good or bad, was my chemistry.
I guess the reason why I ask is, you know, there's a lot of folks that I've become really close with and some folks that we've had on the show who've spent a lot of time in law enforcement, not in the capacity that you have for these prolonged undercover, these huge operations that you've been on. But one thing that I hear over and over again from folks in law enforcement, especially when we start to talk about, you know, this kind of anti-police movement that's kind of taken over the country recently and all of the videos that we're seeing about police brutality and how it's like changing the course of policing. And one thing that I hear from a lot of great cops and guys I really respect is you can't make it personal. Like it's business. You can't make it personal. And when you start making it personal, that's when bad shit. But I think like in your case, what's so fucking astounding to me is like making it personal is kind of everything for you, right? Like you've got to, like making it personal is also like your armor. Like you're not getting, these motherfuckers, no one's getting close to Hell's Angels clubhouses. You're going to New York City, you're making a few phone calls, you're in there fucking an ATF agent, you're in there, like I talked to Mel Chancy today, who as we were talking to today is one of the most feared Hell's Angels in history, Mr. 187, and he was just like, what you were able to do was like fucking unprecedented. And he said, by the way, he's like, they would have never been able to do it to us. He's like, you're able to talk the talk, walk the walk, you always had money on you, you would say you're going to do something, you're going to do it. When violence came up, you threw hands, you were like down to like you. And he said that, like, look, man, like they, you said you guys fucking killed a Mongol and you showed pictures of it. Like, you know, what Mel said is, I guess in the Hell's Angels, in order to even think about getting patched in, it's got to be, you got to know somebody for 5 years, you know?
Yeah.
They said what you did was unprecedented. And I imagine it's because you were able to form these personal relationships. And I guess what I'm so, you know, you had to make this personal, correct?
Yeah, I absolutely. It's got to be personal. It's got to be important to you. But on the other side of that, like, so operationally, it's very personal, right? But then at some point, these people that you've grown to at least like, right, are sitting on the sidewalk in front of their house with their hands cuffed behind their back, right? You have created, I've created the very worst day ever in that person's life, and I'm responsible for it, and there I am standing in front of them. Then the personal side comes off. I never mocked anybody over the course of my career. I never said, like, I got you. See, how's that feel? I tricked you. You fell for it. You bought it. Not one time.
What is the main emotion?
I was the dude who was like, dude, man, you know what? Today is a freaking terrible day for you, man. Yeah. But, like, it can be a great day. Like, you, like, maybe this is what you needed. Mel Chancy, right? No better example. Maybe this is what you needed to get right. Like, man, like, so they're sitting there and they're pissed off and they hate me, right? They want to just rip my throat out. Like, dude, can I get you a cigarette, man? Putting a cigarette in their mouth and moving it in out of their mouth so they can take a drag. Do you need some water? Let me get you a bottle of water. Those small little elements of humanity and compassion. Like, I've had people that I've arrested that said, you know what, man, I didn't like you, but you always treated me good.
That's right.
You always treated me like, and I think that's the key for any of us, man. Treat people the way you want to be treated
in anything, right? And I feel like that's like these great, you know these great cops that I've gotten to know and love over the years, it's like they all have what you're talking about. It's like empathy, man. It's like, hey man, therefore the grace of God go I, man. Like I could be in that situation, and there is this fine line, and there's, you know, at the end of the day, man, we're all playing the cards that we're dealt. There was less just sort of forces separating us, say you're on this side, you're on this side. I mean, the way that you were able to ultimately get these guys off the street at a time in their life where they were causing horrible fucking things, the way you were doing it was to be able to say, hey man, I open my heart up to you.
Well, you know, we're both friends with Mel Chancy. Sure. Like I cannot think of a better example.
Me neither.
The dude was the most dangerous cat on the planet, man, and legit and feared like by everyone, and he earned that. Like that wasn't just because he was bigger than everybody, right. Mel, yes, sir, earned his reputation.
Yeah.
And then he has a downturn, he gets caught up in it, right? And he realized, like probably through that downturn, that God had a bigger plan from him.
Absolutely.
And that he could not fulfill that plan living in a steel cage and eating bologna sandwiches and lime jello for the rest of his life.
Right.
He had to escape that. Right. And now look at like what he's doing with it's his incredible. Life and how he's changing the world.
It's incredible.
And how he's inspiring people towards God.
It's incredible.
Like, how do you not love that?
How do you not love, and he, and like, he talks about you, he like loves you, you know, he loves the guy, he loves Bayless, you know, like he loves, you know, and I guess with that, you know, like, what does it say about criminality in general? You know, something else in your book that really hit me, man, was, you know, I think it was about that, Pops, but it was about like CIs in general, criminal informants, and that you said that, you know, you're really going to folks and you're offering them a chance to do something different, like to have a different kind of purpose, and that a lot of these guys either haven't had that opportunity or they're caught up in the. What can you say sort of about criminal informants in general, and then what can you say sort of about criminality and folks playing the cards that they're look? I think we both know there's some folks that are just deranged, and there's some folks that are just kind of led by a little bit of evil, whatever that is.
Yeah.
But what can you say about sort of the common criminal, and is there another path than just sort of like targeting them, taking them out, incarcerating them? Like, what do you think about that?
Well, I think that a lot of times they end up in the situations they are because they're so desperate, they can't even hope for hope anymore. Like, hope has escaped them. Hope isn't anything that factors in anymore. And when you're hopeless, what do you care? You're going to do whatever it is you do. You know, like now a lot of them are looking for a sense of belonging to something. There's something missing in their life and in that social aspect of life. Like just like taking it down to street gangs. Like a lot of these gang members don't have fathers at home. That gang is their father. That gang provides them that grounding that a dad does. There's Hell's Angels that, like, for different reasons, they wanted to belong to a family. And now if you love that world and the family that is inviting you in is a family that carries with it intimidation and power and respect, and now by putting that patch on your back, like Joe Nobody, all of a sudden you walk in a bar and people are moving out of your way. People want to buy you drinks. People want to give you drugs. Girls want to hang on you. When without that patch, you're invisible. Man, that's pretty powerful, man.
Yes, sir.
Like it's not, it doesn't matter if I agree with it or not. I understand it.
Sure.
Like who doesn't want that?
Sure. Sure.
Right? And that's the vehicle that some guys can get it.
Oh, yeah,
dude.
Yeah. Yeah.
Dude, like straight up rock stars in their world.
Yep.
Like the way they're treated and the way they're admired.
Yep.
No doubt.
Yep. Yep. And you know, you alluded to it a little bit before, but I just I want to just talk briefly about like kind of the betrayal that you felt from the agency in general, and like kind of walk us through that. Your home was burned down, correct? And you know, the Hell's Angels, and then through MS-13 and Aryan Brotherhood, like you had green lights on you and hits. I mean, what the fuck is that like, man?
Right.
I mean, what it like?
The worst part of that entire event was that I had brought that world down on my family. I
can't imagine.
And the code was broken, and it wasn't just about me anymore. It was like hurting me. There was comments made to me like, dude, if like we know how to hurt you and it ain't putting a hole in you, it ain't shooting you, dude. It's freaking hurting your family. Like any of us, like any, like
so anybody. How are those messages delivered to you?
Oh, so many different ways. Like I had firsthand face-to-face conversations. The infiltration case ends, and then my true identity, like who they thought to be J. Bird Davis, turns out to be J. Dobbins instead of the gun runner debt collector, turns out to be an ATF agent. So the Angels issued contracts on me. They were farmed out to the Aryan Brotherhood. They were farmed out to the MS-13. 18th Street picked one up here in Los Angeles. Other side people came in, like lone wolves who wanted to make their bones. There was a letter intercepted out of the prison by the guy that beheaded Cynthia Garcia. Wow. That I helped locked up, that said, like, why are you guys trying to like shoot or stab this dude? Stick him with a AIDS contaminated needle, man. He's going to go down and like, we won't be held accountable for it. Same letter said, you want to make this dude pay? You really want to hurt him? Kidnap his wife and videotape her being gang raped and show it to him. Jesus, you want to hurt him? That's how you hurt him. Threats to kidnap my kids off the bus.
So Jay, how does that, like, what does that do to you, man?
Well, the
like,
hard part.
What's the first emotion when you see something like that?
It's pretty dangerous, right? Because like, I think all of us know like how to solve that.
Yep.
And my frustration was when those threats started coming out that, I never one time said, well, the threats were proven to be credible and valid and reliable threats. They were accurate threats, but like my agency didn't want to investigate them. They were just, there was too many.
Why?
They were too massive. They came to me and said, dude, you're on your own. Where would you like us to start? Would you like us to start with the Hell's Angels, with the contracts? You want us to go to the MS-13? How about if we start working on the ABs? Maybe we'll go talk to 18th Street. What about all this? Where do you want us to start? Like, dude, you're on your own. It's too big. We can't handle it.
But even though you're at this point one of the most distinguished ATF agents of all time, what do you mean you're on your own? Like, I don't.
That's how blunt it was put to me. Like, you're on your own to solve this. So I'm sitting there, I'm like, okay, like I don't really have any resources. I don't have the ability to go hide. There's no witness security for law enforcement.
But I mean, and how are you living your day to day? When you hear, like, are you constantly looking over your shoulder? I mean, what's the mindset?
Looking over my shoulder, paranoid, like wanting help, begging for help, expecting help, feeling like I'd earned or deserved help. And not having it come.
What does this do with you and your wife? Like, where are you guys at? I mean, is she aware of the threats?
Yeah, and why she stuck it out? I don't know, because it would have been really easy for her to cut and run, really easy for her to. And you know, so the agency doesn't react, and like, so I get in a dispute with them. Like, hey man, you need to give me some help here, right? So they double down on me and they unmask all my cover documents. They took all my address had been hidden, my driver's registration, all those things had been, they made that all open source information that was now public record. 3 months after that, my house gets burned down. And then no one comes to investigate the arson. And then I find out behind closed doors, dude, you are the target of the arson. Yeah, I'm like, what? They're like, dude, they've rented office space. They've they've manned a task force and they're recording your calls. They're going to try to pin this arson on you. So like when I talk about, like we talked about earlier about the feelings of betrayal and like how I spent my life betraying people and how I felt like during the way I did my job, I betrayed my family. Like I almost felt like I had it coming. I felt like, dude, you created this karma. Like, how do you like it?
Again, that same thing. You're looking at something you did. Mm. You're looking at your own failure. You're framing this because the only thing that you can change is sort of like making it your part. But this is crazy.
And so the thing is, though, it sounds like I have this like this bitterness about it. I don't. I love ATF. Mm. I love the agents out there with their boots on the ground who are doing it the right way. I ran into a perfect storm of power corruption and arrogance and incompetence in a little window that all took care of each other, that all protected each other. And the trippy thing is the same people that were doing this to me at the exact same time are the people that were running ATF's Operation Fast and Furious and running thousands of assault weapons to the cartels.
Wow.
Which would have never been discovered had Brian Terry, the Border Patrol agent, not been murdered with one of the guns that ATF sent to the cartels. That doesn't happen. Operation Fast and Furious never gets known about.
Wow.
Right? Same cats doing it at the same time. They were, they had insulated themselves. And I guess it's the saying.
Can you just explain Fast and Furious to people that don't know about it?
Yeah. Operation Fast and Furious was this corrupt gun running investigation where ATF, which is tasked with preventing firearms trafficking, in some kind of skewed, like twisted plan, was allowing thousands of assault weapons to go directly to the cartels. And they were like, they were using it for like statistical reasons. They were counting guns in Mexico, and they were like, bodies were stacking up in Mexico, and they were using those dead bodies to justify like how we need more gun control laws here to prevent guns going into Mexico because of all the death and violence that was being created when they were the ones that were creating
Who was funny? Who was profiting off of it? Who?
You know what?
Because of Fast and Furious sort of getting outed, that ultimately outed the guys that were sort of fucking with you.
Yeah, but you know what? Like, none of them paid. Right. None of them paid for what they did to me. None of them paid for Fast and Furious. Actually, some of them got promoted.
Wow.
But for the people that make the rules, there are no rules. Yeah. They can do whatever they want, and they do. And they know they can. And they know they can get away with it.
And do you feel, I mean, I was talking to Mel about this earlier. I mean, do you feel like those threats are still out there for you?
I'll say this. I don't live my life in fear. I live my life with concern. If I put myself in the wrong place at the wrong time with the wrong combination of people, I could have a problem. But do I think that they're hunting me? No.
Right.
I don't hide. Right. I'm not looking for a problem.
Right. You put yourself out there.
I don't hide.
Right.
I live my life with concern. If I get confronted with a problem, I will walk away. If you give me the opportunity, I will run away. But if you corner me, like we're all going to the hospital.
Right.
Like all of us are.
Right.
Like I always felt like I've got God's hand on one shoulder and a pistol on my hip, and between all of us, we'll figure it out.
Yep.
And that's not cocky. I'm not looking for a fight. I don't want to fight. I don't want to fight these dudes. I can't beat these guys.
Yeah.
I've shown I can't beat them.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny because, you know, when I was talking to Mel about it, you know, the way he said is that, you know, honestly, like now looking at your case and what you were able to do, you know, cause I know George Christie a little bit too.
Sure. I know George,
you
know, as well.
You know, I'm dealing with the thing up in my little town where I live. A woman that's really close with us helps raise my kids since they were little. You know, her oldest son, when he was 14, got linked up with a little gang out of Santa Paul. I live in a little town called Ojai, California, and. He's 14 years old, didn't really grow up with a dad, a little bit of abuse. He got linked up with the gang only a couple months, but he got into it with a bigger kid, who was in sort of an offshoot kind of, a gang that was connected with the Angels down in Ventura. And the kid was bigger, he was older. They got into a fight at the party. They both went outside. They agreed to have a fight.
Right.
Both of them pulled out knives. 14-year-old ended up killing the 16-year-old. But he got sentenced to 36 to life. No priors, no nothing, as a minor. But, you know, the Angels really, you know, to this woman that I'm very close with, surrounded her house every night, revving their engine, scared her, intimidated her, threatened her. You know, I really care about this woman. And you know, like I've tried to do sort of what I can do to help.
Those dudes have their PhDs in violence and intimidation. They know how to scare you.
You know, and when I talked to Mel about, you know, this situation, you know, the way he puts it, and I don't know if you've heard this before, but I just found it interesting. It's like, look, man, you got him. Like for him, he's like, at this point, everybody looks at what you did as like, you were just you won. Like you duped them. Like they fucked up. Like, you know, like you beat them and you were.
Yeah.
who you said you were. You had your shit tight, and now there's like sort of like an honor in that. There's like, you know, and like, hey, look, man, if someone's threatening me or my family, that's not going to necessarily make me sleep well at night. But I just, I wonder what you thought of that.
Yeah. Whether you've encountered that. I've got relationships on various levels with current and ex Hell's Angels. And I've had, you know, like pretty dangerous guys saying like, look, dude, I don't like you. I don't like the way you did this, but you're pretty dang good at it, man. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we understand that we do what we do, and there's guys out there that do what you do. You were better than us.
That's right.
Like no one gets a trophy for it. That's no one gets a trophy for winning.
That's right.
Right?
That's right.
Ultimately, they won.
Right.
After 2 years of pain and suffering and blood and violence and all the stuff, and then all the aftermath and all my battle with ATF, the Hell's Angels are stronger today than they were when I started on them. They didn't get weaker. They got better. Mm. They got smarter.
Mm.
You know, I've had complaints with my No Angel book. People are saying, dude, like, okay, good story, good cop story, right? Interesting. You inspired people to become Hell's Angels with that. People like saw the other side of it, the glamour on the dark side of it. Like you, like that's a recruiting tool for them. And I'm like, oh, okay. Okay. It's because it's all about choices.
Yeah.
Like for all of us, right? Everyone's sitting here, look at yourself and say, choices you made earlier in your life, the ones you made obviously put you on a path, like you're successful and you're famous and you're a movie star. You could have made a choice that exact same day had you locked up.
Oh man, I was right there.
It's choices, 100%,
man. 100%.
And like when you're a young kid and you don't have life's experiences behind you and you're confronted with those life choices, man, you can't get it wrong, because when you do, it's unrecoverable.
What are you most proud of? Like, what are you most proud of?
I'm proud of my family.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm proud of them for them. I'm proud of them. They really truly showed me what love is, because they stuck by me, and that, mm-hmm. like, I gave them no reason to. I gave them that there's absolutely no reason why they should be in my life. And even if they were removed from my life, there's really no reason for them to even have any communication with me. Mm-hmm. That's how much battle damage I put on them. Wow. And there they are, man.
Wow.
Every day. There they are.
That's beautiful, man. And right now with this, you know, like this sort of like anti-cop movement in this country, like what's your take on that?
Well, I mean, you look like we're filming one day removed from the Uvalde shooting in Texas. We're a week removed from Buffalo, from the supermarket shooting in Buffalo. So there's all these arguments out there of, you know, like more gun laws, gun control, right? I think we need to do something different. If I knew the solution, I would offer it, but I know what the answer is not. I don't know what the answer is. I know what it's not.
What's it not?
The answer is not to take money away from the police, to have less police. That is not the answer. We need to give, like the exact opposite of defund the police. Absolutely. Overfund the police, get more cops, train them better. Every expert out there, and I'm not an expert, every expert out there says like, dude, train them to de-escalate, train them, like all the things that
hands.
The shortcomings
yeah,
are.
Exactly. Absolutely.
Right? Don't take money away from them. Don't try to weaken them. It weakens all of us, man.
Do you have any opinion, you know, with what happened, you know, yesterday?
I mean, oh my goodness.
I know, man. I mean, I mean, look, man, like your perspective on like illegal guns. I mean, that's what you did, man. I mean, like what do you think about that? What's your take on guns? What's your take on how easy it is to get them? Like, you know, I know you said, I mean, like, are you a big gun guy? Do you still carry like
carry, but I wouldn't consider myself a gun guy or a gun expert by mm-hmm. any means. Mm-hmm. I do believe this, there's 350 million guns in the United States. If I am a criminal, or if I have a violent mindset and I'm willing to go out and murder someone, which is the ultimate sin, the ultimate crime, do I care what the gun law says
right.
about my ability to get it? Like, we both know, and like we're in an affluent area here, right? We both know in 10 minutes, we could get our hands on a gun without knowing anybody in this neighborhood, just going around and starting to shake some hands.
100%.
In 10 minutes, we'd have a
100%.
Gun if you really wanted it.
100%.
Right? And that's not that's not like an undercover guy talking mm-hmm. that, or that's not a guy who's experienced in that world and the techniques. That's anybody.
Anybody. Dude. Anybody. You know, when I bring my gun with me every time I come to the city. I live out in the country. Every time I come to the city, I always bring it with me. That is so different from like how I was when I was growing up. Like I grew up in a city that was the murder capital of the country. You know, like Nick will tell you, you know, we grew up in an environment where like, you know, where we grew up, it was like pretty safe, you know, but you went a block to the left, you block to the right. And there's kids getting shot at school. There was just shootings all the time. And so I was growing up, you know, to really like hate guns, I to despise them. And if you had a problem with somebody, you settled it with your hands. Like that's what you did. I just feel like for me, you know, now this kind of front row ticket that I get in different cities to law enforcement and getting to know these people from the shows I do and the relationships that I get to make, doesn't seem to be like that anymore. Everyone's shooting each other.
The gun is the great equalizer. When you were kids, you'd slug it out, right? The best fighter or the biggest guy or the strongest guy wins. Doesn't work like that anymore.
Right.
The skinniest, most punky, most wimpy, most coward can win because the gun is the great equalizer.
So is the answer then? Is the answer then more guns? Arm more people in schools? Like what do you think?
It's just like it's such a societal question.
Yeah,
you look at like you just look at the world like and the gun argument part of it. You look at like the issues on the border. You look at the war in Ukraine. You look at the abortion issues are all back on fire. Well, not that they've never been not on fire, but they're
now
like
they're
in prevalent
right
again.
Yep.
Gas prices, the economy. And as a society, we're freaking giving two fucks about what's going on with Johnny Depp and Amber Heard.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Like,
it's crazy.
Really?
It's crazy. So right now, I mean, like you coach football, you coach in high school football. You know, you're in a position right now where like you're shaping young men's lives and hearts in a way. I mean, some of the people that have the biggest effect in my life are my high school football coaches.
Right.
And I'm just wondering, like, you know, what are you seeing sort of like in the young men that you coach? What are you seeing in that high school environment? What are you seeing that encourages you? What are you seeing that like disappoints you? How does what happened yesterday in Texas, how does it, you know, how does it play upon sort of like your role as a coach and mentor for these young men?
Well, my kids are out of school, but like I know that you still have younger kids. Like how terrorizing to have kids going to school now and not knowing if like when you send them off or when you put them on the school bus, whether you get to see them at the end of the day. And like, it's not like some kind of dream sequence, illusion or imagination. It's real, dude.
It's happening all the time.
I think I read a stat where there's been 30 school shootings this year. We're at the end of May. When we're at a point where you have as good a chance of getting shot going to school as you do doing a drug deal?
Yeah.
Tell you what, there wasn't 19 or 26 drug murders yesterday. Right. I mean, maybe there was.
Maybe.
But between second and fifth or sixth grade?
Yeah, it's insane. It's insane.
It's, you know what? To be honest with you, I mean, I spent like my entire professional life trying to make an impact on that. And it's like the entirety of it has caused me to question everything I ever stood for and everything I ever believed in. And it's, I don't want to give up, but like there's days when I just want off the merry-go-round. Mm-hmm. I just want off the merry-go-round. Mm-hmm. Like I did nothing. I accomplished nothing. I changed nothing. I don't know.
I think that, you know, I imagine like, you know, it's all about what can we do today and like, who can we influence today and what can we, you know, I don't know. I mean, it is. I mean, there's no like easy way to, you know, talk about kind of, you know, what happened yesterday. And I can't imagine what these folks are going through. And I just,
don't think if you haven't lost a kid or lost a kid in those circumstances, all you can do is empathize with it and show mm-hmm. compassion for it, because you can't say like, oh man, I know how that feels.
Mm-hmm.
No, actually, you know what? You don't.
Yep.
If you haven't gone through it, you have
no idea.
I have no idea what that feels like.
Yep.
No idea.
Yep.
All I can do is try to be compassionate for it, empathetic towards it. I have no idea what that feels like.
Yeah. Yeah. And not pretend like we got the answers, you know?
No.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was at Columbine High School about 6 hours after the, that was the first, not the first school shooting, but the first big one,
yeah.
Right? And I can honestly say my DNA was altered that day, like walking around that crime scene. I went from being a pretty happy, joyful person to being a really angry, like I wanted to just go like rage and fight and like lock people up and like take guns off the street and stand in between like the good and innocent people in the communities and the predators who wanted to ruin that for them. I like it really set that home. I really like began to take a lot of pride in the responsibility in that. But like my DNA changed that day. And it wasn't like there's dead bodies of these kids in the school, in the cafeteria, in the library. And there's, and I mean, it was a mess. And I'll tell you what burned on me. And I still can't get that vision out of my head. There were backpacks. There were book bags scattered all over that campus.
Wow.
Like, and you'd think that like you'd be focused on the body of a kid, you know, or the blood stains and the carnage there. Like, I don't, like, my brain somehow has kind of erased that, but I can't get rid of all those book bags, all those backpacks scattered everywhere. Kids were shucking their belongings, and, like, kids who went to school that day to, like, enjoy their friends, go to class, go to their after-school activities, go to sports, ended up, like, running for their lives and dying there that day. And I was, like, so, so angry with that. Like I was going to, like, I'm going to do something about this or right die now. Trying.
Yep. Man, I this was like truly awesome, bro. Like I admire you so much, man. And I think beyond all else, I mean, not even all these incredible, the life that you're living and the life that you lead, but, you're just like super humble, man. And honest and direct. And I'm a better guy for knowing you, man.
It's very kind. I
really, really appreciate you. You doing it, and I got just undying, limitless respect for you, bro. And,
I think for all of us, for like what you do, for all of us here on your crew, for me, like just try to change the world for the better.
Yeah,
like I said, like maybe it's just one person.
Yeah,
maybe it's one moment in one person's day.
That's right.
All those events have made me more spiritual. I lost everything. I lost my reputation, like any thought I had of leaving a legacy. I was bankrupted by my fight against the government. I had destroyed my family relationships. I'd lost friends. Friends had turned their back on me. I lost everything. And then I realized after everything's gone, like God was still there. Like he was still there, man. Like in spite of all my mistakes and all the things I screwed up, he was still there. And I learned one really important thing. If the only time you're talking to God is when you're in trouble, you're in trouble.
You're in trouble. That's right.
You know? So the great thing, the best thing, and why I wouldn't change anything is because all of that brought me closer to God. God doesn't come in and rescue you from all your suffering.
Right.
He uses that suffering to pull you closer to him. Like you have to go through that. And he's like saying like, are you going to come to me? Are you going to turn to me? Are you going to have faith? Are you going to believe? Or are you going to keep trying to do things your way, Jay? Because check it out, dude, they don't work out good on your plan. Follow my plan.
Mm-hmm.
I had to learn that the hard way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, information does not necessarily equal knowledge. Knowledge does not necessarily equal wisdom. Mm-hmm. And for me, like wisdom was always something that came to me right after I needed it.
Right. Thank you.
Right on, man. Thank you for having me. Thank you guys too. Thanks for taking care of me.